calling. You've dialed the wrong number. Sorry. What good is that? How can you ever repay the 30 seconds you have stolen from my life? I hate you, your husband, your children, and your relatives.
Welcome to a desperate edition of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
I'd like to stick my whole head in your mouth and let you suck on my eyeballs.
Maybe later, but first we're going to go to Mortville with Peggy Gravel and Griselda Brown in John Waters' 1977 fairy tale film, Desperate Living. Waters' regular Mink Stole plays Peggy Gravel, a completely unhinged suburban housewife who's made Griselda, played by Gene Hill, smothers Peggy's husband. Pursued by a very kinky policeman, the pair head to Mortville, a refuge of wretched refuse, lorded over by Queen Carlotta, played by the one and only Edith Massey. In Mortville, Peggy and Griselda meet Muffy St. Jocks and Mole McHenry, a lesbian couple. Susan Lowe is Mole McHenry, and sex goddess Liz Renee is Muffy St. Jocks. Also along for the ride is Marion Vivian Pierce as Queen Carlotta's daughter, Princess Cuckoo, and a bunch of guys in leather gear as Queen Carlotta's royal servants. Just to put this film in context, when we talk about John Waters films, we usually focus on 1972's Pink Flamingos and 1981's Polyester. In between came Female Trouble and Desperate Living in 77. Production values had definitely increased for this film, with a lot of it being shot in a rather elaborate Mortville set. A lot of folks tend to overlook Desperate Living. This might be because it's wonderfully gross, or maybe that's one of the few John Waters films that, at least at this point, didn't feature Divine. So, Justin, what are your thoughts on Desperate Living or Living Desperate?
You know, listen, this is a John Waters movie, and I'm a huge admirer of John Waters. You know, I've loved all of his films for as long as I can remember. And, you know, Desperate Living is one of those films where you can tell Waters is trying to push the envelope, but in a different way than he did with Pink Flamingos. You know, Pink Flamingos had a very gross out connotation. This one is more, it's pushing level, but on a smarter level. You know, he's doing things in it like trying to shock you with sexuality. And, you know, one of my favorite scenes in Desperate Living is when they put Edith Massey in the cage. Love that scene. Only because I've been there. But anyways, yeah, you know, I love Desperate Living. It's sadly, it's not in my top five Waters films, but I know we'll cover that later. But I do certainly appreciate it, you know, for what it is. And I really appreciate that this was Waters' first film to cast an infamous person in it as well. You had Liz Renee, who, of course, went to prison. She was the girlfriend of the mobster, Mickey Cohen. I really appreciate it for that. It's kind of, I feel like it's his transitional film from this one period to the next period, which, and it's almost like the end of the transition too, where you see John Waters' evolution, and then after Desperate Living comes Polyester, and then it just sort of becomes more subtle as it goes along, you know. And now he's trying to return to his roots, I feel like, over the last few films. But it's an interesting period, John Waters. I think it's definitely worth a watch for that.
Yeah, stuff just kind of skyrocketed after Polyester. Polyester seemed to be the one where he really got notice from more mainstream critics, you know. Polyester was probably the first John Waters films that I was going to see talked about on Siskel and Ebert, you know. So it's like, if Siskel and Ebert were talking about it, you know that it's reached America's heartland and that folks are going to hear about this film. And it's very ironic that as we're recording this, Spy Kids 4 is out and they have their Aromarama or whatever, and Polyester was Odorama back in, you know, 1980 something. How far we've not come over the years.
Yeah, and that's a you know, again, that's Waters' homage to his influences. You know, he grew up, he loved William Castle movies, and William Castle was the king of the gimmick. You know, he had, the seats that shocked people in The Tingler, and he had the 3D glasses for 13 Ghosts. So it's just an homage to that. It's really great. Also, Polyester was the first film I ever saw in Waters on cable. You know, at least played on Comedy Channel. And I think Polyester was ahead of its time because, you know, he's parroting the Serkian melodrama. You know, you see that coming, that trend getting really popular right now. you know, because you had Todd Haynes doing Fire from Heaven, and you have his revisit of Mildred Pierce, the Serkin melodramas. We're getting off topic. Let's go back to Desperate Living.
I know we're going to get off topic quite a bit. I mean, I later on in the show, we're going to play some interviews that I did with Waters and with Mink Stoll, and I know that I get off topic with Mink a whole lot, because really, like you said, this is a transitional film, so you really have to talk about this in the context of Waters' other works to see how this works or doesn't work. There are some folks that just didn't get this one who don't really care for it, which is understandable. I will point to the first thing, which I love, and I can see a lot of people hating, which is Mink Stoll's performance as Peggy Gravel. The first thing we see in this film is, well, other than somebody eating a rat, is Peggy Gravel at home. She's just come out of a mental institution, and she is absolutely unhinged. She is just ranting and raving and screaming, and I found this to be very great, and I can see where a lot of folks would just be like, oh my God, is this woman ever going to shut up?
Ah! Oh, I knew they'd try it! Trying to kill me in my own home! It's like war! Don't tell me! I don't know what Vietnam is like! Rats! Rats! Rats!
Oh, Mom! Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Gravel. I'll pay for the window out of my allowance.
How about my life? Do you get enough allowance to pay for that? I know you were trying to kill me. What's the matter with the courts? Do they allow this lawlessness and malicious destruction of property to run rampant? I hate the Supreme Court!
All of her lines are just completely over the top, and just they build on each other. Starting off at that fever pitch could really turn a lot of folks off, but I thought her performance is terrific. And she's one of the most dislikable main characters that I've seen in a long time.
What makes her character great is it says so much about contemporary culture, because you have these very uptight people that are so repressed and so, you know, want to adhere to the rules of society. That what does that say about the culture that, you know, she's this nut that can totally forget all that repression, you know, and just go off and do some of the most filthiest, disgusting things? Every human being is capable of it. Why do we all not live in a John Waters world? That's what I'm saying. We need to. I think everyone would be a lot happier in a John Waters world.
I would definitely enjoy serving under Queen Carlotta.
I think you want to get with Gene Hill, let's be honest. I got to get me some of Gene Hill. John Waters sure could shoot a sex scene. I mean,
first person being smothered by a large black woman on film, I believe. John Waters talks about how he had to go through a lot of auditions in order to find the Griselda character, and finally found Gene Hill, and she was just absolutely tremendous. Once they get to Mortville, you know, Mortville was this just amazing set. It felt like a kid's movie at times to me. And, you know, I did call this a fairy tale earlier, and it definitely is very much, let's say, Wizard of Oz, where they're on the run at the beginning. You know, Dorothy's trying to escape from the mean old woman who wants her dog, and she crosses over the rainbow and ends up in this fairy tale world. This film kind of turns that whole thing on its head, where they escape and they get to Mortville, where everyone is completely mortified and they all have these horrible pasts, and now they basically have to pay for their sins in this place and being lorded over by this absolutely crazy queen. This one was very different for Waters in that the production values were super high.
I think it's funny that you say that. Like, can you imagine what it would have been like to have been on that set? You know, they built that set like out in the middle of the woods somewhere. You know, it's like, geez, you're just walking through the woods. All right, everybody, let's go to the woods and shoot our movie. Like, how surreal is this? It's a surreal movie, but it had to have been a surreal experience to make it, too.
In the director's commentary for this one, John was talking about the rats and stuff that they kept in cages. I think he might talk about that a little bit in shock value as well. And just, yeah, just how horrible the set was, and people, you know, getting colds and stuff, and like Liz Renee getting the flu really bad, just being super high on cough medicine while they were filming this. Yeah, we should talk a little bit more about Liz Renee. I mean, this, you know, John Waters is kind of famous now for his, I don't know, I guess stunt casting might be a good word for it. You know, he's used
Patty Hearst
quite a few times, and, you know, as he's gotten bigger, he's been able to cast more mainstream actors, which I guess that would be kind of stunt casting. I mean, had you said at one point, like, oh, hey, did you know that someday in the future, yeah, Tracy Ullman, or, well, even Tracy Lords was another kind of stunt cast thing that he did in Crybaby. Rick Ocasek and Pia Zadora, those kind of things, you know. But even had you said, like, hey, did you know Melanie Griffith is going to be in one of your films someday? I would consider that kind of a stunt cast thing as well. So an unexpected actor showing up in one of his films. But yeah, Liz Renee, as you said, was the girlfriend of mobster Mickey Cohen. You can see a lot more of Mickey Cohen in L.A. Confidential, obviously a fictionalized version of him. Yeah, Liz Renee, who I think she was trying to build herself as kind of the next Marilyn Monroe for a while. And man, she was good looking. I was very surprised at how good looking she was.
Yeah, she did a lot of modeling, and I know that she did some earlier films as well, you know, but I think going to prison kind of ruined her. But she did write a couple books. And I know that, you know, John Waters was a fan of those books, and he did try to incorporate, like, one of the, I can't remember what movie it is. I think it maybe is Polyester, maybe. They worked the titles of Liz Renee's books into the dialogue. You know, she was this interesting anomaly that is kind of a footnote for me in terms of Waters. Like, I'd rather talk about casting Ricky Lake in the John Waters movies or the Patty Hearst performances in John Waters movies. I just think, you know, Patty Hearst is more of an enigmatic character anyways.
Some people would consider Desperate Living to be a footnote to Waters' filmography as it is, you know, because it is between two of his more important films. Or, you know, I know that there's Female Trouble in there, but people look at, you know, certain milestone films for him. But we were talking earlier about a top five of John Waters, and I'd love to hear what your top five John Waters films are.
I tend to like the earlier Waters films more. Number five on my list is Multiple Maniacs. And that was sort of like...
That's a good one.
Yeah, that was sort of one of the first ones I saw. And I remember I saw it high on LSD for the first time. And it just kind of blew my mind, you know, just because of the whole lobster raping and the Stations of the Cross and the, you know, the cavalcade of perversions, you know, David Lockery, like, see two bags kissing each other on the lips and they love it. You know, I love that. And then, after that is I really am an admirer of Serial Mom. I know you and I are big fans of that movie. And, you know, I really appreciate Serial Mom for what it is, because that's kind of, it seems like it's a transitional film for him too, because, you know, he's reaching the next level of stunt casting, as you call it. You know, you got total, and what's brilliant about Serial Mom too is how he takes these unlikely stars and makes them fit into his brand of humor, you know. Especially, it's quite a shock to see, you know, Sam Waterston in Serial Mom. And, you know, my favorite scene in Serial Mom is the Kathleen Turner, Sam Waterston sex scene. This is so hilarious. You know, followed up by that, I'm a huge fan of Female Trouble. I think it's another overlooked Waters film. It's just so trashy. And it's the only movie you see an actor rape himself. You know, and I love the fact, just there's so many funny moments and it's so over the top. It's really a chronicle of John Waters' obsession with serial killers and, you know, crime. And, you know, there's the great scene of Divine's character getting mad at her parents because she didn't get the cha-cha heels.
Oh, I love the cha-cha heels thing.
ruining Christmas by pushing her over the tree. I love that. And then I know this one's going to come to a surprise too, because I don't think you're a fan of it, but I'm a really big admirer of Pecker.
Really?
Yeah, and I really love Pecker because actually, I was one of the ones, the last Waters films I actually saw in the theater, and I thought it was just hilarious. I thought it was very clever, and it really poked fun at the art world, which desperately needs poking at constantly. My favorite bit about seeing Pecker in the theater was you've got that scene in Pecker with Edward Furlong as Pecker looking through the window of the strip club, and John Waters has that close-up of that just hairy vagina, and the big screen, you can only imagine what I saw. Like, it was literally like this 20-foot, you know, long by 10, 15-foot tall vagina in front of you. It was just phenomenal to see. You know, it's like, now that's a vagina I would like to see in person. Anyway, so yeah, I love Pecker. I think it's hilarious. And then, of course, number one, I'm a huge fan of Pink Flamingos. It was probably either Multiple Maniacs or Pink Flamingos. I can't remember which one I saw first, but I'm a really big fan of Pink Flamingos. I think it's a brilliant satire. And again, that was another one. You know, that's just the ultimate gross-out movie. You can't get any grosser than Pink Flamingos. It's a testament to Waters as a director that he's able to convince his actors to do these things. And then also, it was another one that I got to see. I was privileged enough to see it on the big screen one time, and it just blew me away just to be in the audience. And you come to the end of Pink Flamingos, and you hear the audience just go, it was amazing.
I like parts of Pecker, like his grandmother with the Virgin Mary statue.
Full of grace! Full of grace!
And I get to see a good friend of mine, Scott Unpainted Huff Hines, getting teabagged in that. So that's always nice to see. I'm kind of sad that the whole right-wing Republican movement has taken teabagging as their name now. Kind of ruins that movie for me a little bit. For me, my top five would be Pink Flamingos. I also had the pleasure of seeing that one in the theater. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, that was awesome to see. I think my favorite part in there is the furniture licking scene. I love Serial Mom as well. Kathleen Turner, when she's kind of flapping her legs open and closed underneath the table while she's on trial, is probably my favorite part of that one. Polyester. I love Polyester. I love the Baltimore foot stomper in that. I'm a big fan of Hairspray. I'll even say that I like the musical, the dancing musical Hairspray, but I really like the original the best. I especially love Jerry Stiller in that one. It's up there for me. I'll watch that one anytime. And then Desperate Living. Something about this film really has a place in my heart. It just really struck a chord with me. So let's go ahead and we'll play some interviews. Like I said before, I had the pleasure of speaking to John Waters and Ming Stoll about Desperate Living and a few other things. The John Waters one, not affected by Justin's great computer crash of 2011, but it was affected by a screw up on Skype. At one point, his phone cut out and my recorder thought that the conversation had ended, so it stopped recording. So that was a lot of fun. So it's missing about 10 minutes. So we will have 10 minutes of silence throughout this interview. So if you need to get a beverage or anything, just listen for that point and go ahead and get that. And hopefully you'll enjoy one of our favorite parts of the show.
And I want to note that the screw up wasn't my fault.
No, not your fault whatsoever. So let's go ahead and roll those interviews. Can you tell me how the idea for the film came about?
I can. You know, Desperate Living did the worst of all my movies financially. It's the only one of my movies that I never got a TV deal for. I'm talking from Pink Flamingos on. And it's for many reasons. I guess looking at it today, it is especially grim and rude. But I got the idea. I was hanging around with Chris Mason a lot, who did all the hairdos in my movies. She's no longer with us, but she died. I don't mean she's not with our company. But she was great. And she did all the giant hairdos and Female Trouble and everything. And she had a lesbian bar called Sappho's. And these were some scary lesbians, let me tell you. And I was the only man that was allowed in. But a lot of the lesbians hated me, but Chris stuck up for me, right? And they had a magazine called Desperate Living that was a lesbian newsletter. And I took the title from it, which really enraged them, because I thought, well, how can you have this, like, pro-gay magazine if it's called Desperate Living? And it was just, like, sad stories about being lesbians. That is where the idea came from, to do a lesbian melodrama. And Chris worked on it. Chris is in it, even. So a lot of the gay women I know were in it, in Shotzi's bar, and the bar where Cookie is. It was all the lesbians I knew from the bar.
It does have a real different tone than a lot of your films, at least up to that point. What do you attribute that to?
Who knows, you know? Maybe I was unhappy then. No, I guess it is the least joyous of my movies. And when it came out, well, I think it probably didn't do as well because Divine wasn't in it, and people were used to Divine being in it. I think Su Lo was incredibly brave to take over the part. Su Lo was not a lesbian, and she's not butch, and we shaved all her hair off and put moles on her and made her look like a complete monster, and her own children ran from her screaming, and her boyfriend broke up with her because I don't think he could have sex with Mole. He was horrified. So Susan Lo was really brave to do that. She also gave us her son to use as Divine's baby in Female Trouble. So Sue was a hardcore dreamland girl, believe me, and still is.
I was wondering if it maybe, because you had said in the past that it was the first script you wrote when you weren't on pot, so maybe that's where that came.
No, I don't think that had anything to do with it. And what, did I say that? I guess that was true. Yeah, probably was true. But, you know, I didn't write any of the other ones on pot either, and later, and so they didn't look. I think it was very influenced by this grim world that I was in of these really working class lesbians, and we all hung out there. And we all thought, so I wanted to make, I mean, really, it's pretty today. I mean, Chaz says she didn't get bottom surgery because they have not figured out how to do it. And I've seen pictures. I went to Dr. John Money, who did sex changes. He gave me pictures of what it looks like. And that hideous thing that you see in Desperate Living is what it looks like. It looks like a turkey leg. That's why women to men sex changes don't want to get it, because they can't do it right. So the movie, I guess, today is actually, when it came out at the time, lesbians picketed against it. They stopped it from being shown at the Orson Welles Cinema in Boston, which was a place where all my movies shown. But now lesbians bring it to colleges. It's a favorite with lesbians. So some lesbians, you know, so I don't know. To me, I think it's probably more like today. I know so many women that have beards now, and so many women that are, especially in San Francisco, that are going through sex changes, and that Chaz is certainly the most famous of them, but it's certainly a lot more common today than it was when we made that movie. It was almost unheard of when we made that movie.
You say that Divine was going to play Mole, so
yes.
Would it have been like the turkey leg over her gaff? I mean,
well, you wouldn't have seen it. No, Divine was, I meant Divine the actor was going to play it. Divine would have looked exactly like what Mole looked like with Sue Lo. I mean, you know, she's bigger, but no, it wasn't Divine playing the Divine character. That's why it was going to be such an image change. For Divine to play a butch lesbian was something that he never played. And that fake sex change that Sue Lo wore, you didn't see her real vagina, and you wouldn't have seen Divine's real penis. Well, but Divine was playing a man in it anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, Divine was playing a lesbian anyway. I mean, same way in all my movies, the fact that Divine was really a man was not part of the plot. It was never like in drag shows, how they reveal at the end. No, it was Divine in not one of my movies was part of the plot when Divine's character was a woman, that Divine was really a man. That was never part of the plot.
Yeah, it would have been a neat turn of things that he's getting a sex change into a man.
Well, I think I don't know. It wouldn't have been any more confusing, I think, because I think what people couldn't imagine was Divine, who before that, now later we changed his image, and when he got the best reviews, but up till that movie, he had only played the Divine character that people think of as, but that wasn't the real Divine. He didn't look like that in real life. People thought he did. But once that image was established, and we later changed it, is when he started to get good reviews, because then he was playing against type. And this was supposed to be the beginning of Divine playing against type. But I understand Divine was in a show. It was doing well, and it was good for Divine to be having success without me. So we just worked with what we got, and Sue Lo was great. She was like the understudy who came in and was very brave to do it.
You know, I've heard you talk about Edith Massey and of course Mink Stole before, but I don't know what the origin is. How did you meet Edith, and how did you meet Mink?
Mink Stole, I knew her sister first, who was named Seek at the time, like Sick, but her name's Seek now. But I knew her in Provincetown, and then I met Mink in Provincetown. Even though we were all from Baltimore, I met Mink for the first time in Baltimore, and she was still Nancy then. But I asked her to be in Roman Candles, which was the movie we made in 1966, which was very right around the time I met her, I think. And then I said, oh, let's call you Mink Stole, because her real name's Nancy Stole. And then we even lived together for a very, very short time in New York, and we lived together in Provincetown at Prescott's, which was a submarine in a tree, basically. And Mink, you know, I said to her recently, how come you never told me you could sing? And she said, I didn't know it, because she's really a good singer. The act is not campy or anything. Mink can really sing. That's why I put one of her records on my Date with John Waters CD album. She's really a good singer, and it's not what you think. It's not rock and roll. It's kind of like Julie London. I mean, she can really do. She does Edith Piaf numbers that are really great. So I'm amazed. I think she's really, really talented, and I can't wait to hear the album. I've gone to see her many times. I saw her in New York. I saw her in Baltimore, and it's a good act, and I'm really happy that she has yet another way to get Mink Stole out there in the world. So I knew Mink, but I actually knew her sister Seek first, and her brother George, who's a very, very good artist today, was in the only scene from Pink Flamingos, the cutout, where when he was a teenager, Divine had simulated sex with him in a giant garbage dump in a big bin. But it was fake, you know. But I never put that back in when we did the final 25th anniversary. It was the only scene I didn't restore.
So I just listened to Shock Value.
You listened to it? What do you mean you listened? You have the tape?
Yeah, I have the audio tape of it.
Wow, that's a, I haven't seen that one in a while. Okay.
Yeah, a friend of mine converted it from tape to MP3, right. So it still has the nice hiss and everything on it. It's pretty great. You had talked in there about a scene that was in Pink Flamingos with I can't remember the gentleman's name, but kind of a mirror, mirror on the wall scene.
That was, yeah, the guy, Billy, who it never turned out. That's the only reason I didn't put it on the extras. There was a whole scene where Divine, like Snow White, looks in the mirror and talks about who's the filthiest person alive, and he answered her. And Billy was the guy that I just saw at a street corner, and at the time he had a big like James Brown conk hairdo and wore like pimp type outfits. And he had that Cadillac limousine that the Marbles drive in it, and we rented it from him. But he would come to our house at the time and kind of hang out, and he was quite a character. And I never saw him again. And he played the man in the mirror. But then I never saw him again till about 2 years ago in Baltimore, and he came over to me, and I wouldn't have recognized him because it was, you know, 40 years later or something. And he said, introduced and said who he was, and that he was in a jazz band, and it was great to see him again. It was just amazing to remember that that's him. Oh, my God, I hadn't seen him since the day we shot it. I never saw him again when we didn't rent the car.
Yeah, I have to say, Edith Massey is in rare form in Desperate Living.
Well, she was happy for once she got to look what she thought was pretty. I mean, she hated that female trouble black leather outfit. So for Edith, she was really happy to be wearing costumes that she thought was flattering. And they were.
Is there parts of what she says that's ad-lib too? Some of her dirty talk?
Not much, except in the sex scene when she's saying, oh, daddy, baby, come on. You know, some of that is, yeah. But no, it was all written.
I believe it's your night to service me, Lieutenant Wilson.
I'm always eager, Your Highness.
Oh, that love muscle. Whip it out and show it hard. Ooh. Oh, come on, Daddy. Fuck me. Come on. Ooh, glow, little inchworm. Oh, look at those balls. Oh, Daddy, come on. Ooh, look at that pelt. Yeah. Ooh, come on. Oh, come on, Lieutenant. I haven't got all night. Don't bother with the head. The V of my crotch is what needs the attention.
But I can fuck like a bandit, Your Highness.
Well, wrap my safety deposit box, then. Dig for gold. Dig for gold.
Oh, Your Highness, I'm entering your arms.
Oh, Daddy, go all night. Get it. Get it. Get it. Get it.
Oh, jeez, that line about the V.
The V of her crotch, that's because of Peyton Place, the great line by great Metellius that I always, Grace Metellius, that I always said was my favorite first book was Peyton Place, and they talk about the V of Betty's crotch, and I kept trying to get Edith to say the V of her crotch, but she kept saying crouch, and all through it, she says, get it, get the V of my crouch. I met Edith. She worked in kind of a wino bar in Fells Point where Vincent Perenia, who's the production designer for all my movies, where he first moved down there and kind of started that community. And Sue Lowe lived down there too. And they both said to me, you got to meet this woman that works in this bar called Pete's Hotel that was really like a wino bar. It's the one you see in Multiple Maniacs. And I went in there and met her. And that's how I met her. And she played herself really in Multiple Maniacs. And people just liked her and I liked her. And then she was like an outsider comedian, but the fans liked her too. I mean, a lot of the actors didn't like working with her because she could never remember her lines, but she really tried hard. And there were long monologues then. When I look back on it, even now when I'm in movies, I think, God, I was mean because I can't remember dialogue very well either. And they had to remember 5 pages of dialogue in one take.
Yeah, there were some long stretches in Desperate Living.
There were some long stretches of shouting, yes.
Yeah, I love Mink's performance in that. I mean, it sets that tone.
From the beginning, that's my real mother's bedroom.
Yeah, and you said that you got to break her window for that scene.
Yeah. And I love, that's like when Mink says, I hate the Supreme Court for no reason. That's one of my favorite lines.
You said that it wasn't very well received when it came out?
Not really. I mean, I remember Variety had like a one paragraph review that said, amateur night in the psycho ward. Little attention was paid to it. Didn't open, did it open as a midnight movie? I can't even remember if it did. It opened at the Cinema Village, I think. It didn't open it at one of the houses at the time that was the best place to open, really. No, it opened at the Quad, and which later became, what did the Quad become? I don't remember. But it didn't open where we wanted it to open, which was probably the Waverly, or which is now the IFC Theater. So it didn't get the highest profile midnight booking. The critics, there were some good reviews, but not enough. It was also, things were changing at the time, and it was also pretty grim. So I don't know, it didn't do that well at the box office, but, you know, I eventually got the money. I think it only cost $65,000, and I think it took 20 years to get all the money back, or 15 years. So it eventually did, and through video and DVDs and stuff, it's still alive and still out there. And it weirdly mutated, but now a lot of people, the really hardcore fans, like that one the best. And to me, I like them all the same. They're kind of all the same. That one is especially loud and people screaming in a monotone all through it, which I think I was very influenced by Tora Sutano's performance in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And I also never had good sound. I just wanted to make sure that people could hear it. I was the opposite of mumblecore. I was shoutcore. Yeah.
I love the sets in the movie, and I love that whole fairy tale look to it and everything, especially at the end.
Well, that's Vincent Perrenio working on a budget of almost nothing, too, at the time. I mean, Mortville was built out of garbage, except for the castle. Everything they had, they found in the garbage. We tried to make it, like, really the poor man's Disneyland. That was kind of what we were going after.
You said that there were animal corpses and rats and things on the set?
You know, I don't remember. There was always rats.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
You were in Pink Flamingos and other of John's early stuff. How did you get involved with him?
I met John in Provincetown in the summer of 66. It's been 45 years. My sister actually introduced us. She knew him in Baltimore, but I didn't. And by the end of the summer, he and I and my sister and four or five other people were all roommates. We were all living together in this very funky place at the edge of Provincetown. Then at the end of the summer, John and I went to New York together, and we got an apartment on Hudson Street, where we lasted a month. But both of us, New York terrified me. I was 19 years old, but New York really scared me. I was pretty much a small town girl. I kept getting lost or in the village. And John was homesick, so we both moved back in with our respective parents. And then one day he called me up and said, "Do you want to be in this movie?" And being not stupid, I said yes. And it was a movie called Roman Candles. I don't know if you've ever seen it. His second film that he ever made, the first one he made before I met him, which was Hag in a Black Leather Jacket, but this was Roman Candles, which requires 3 8-millimeter projectors and a tape recorder to show. So, you know, I mean, it was not linear. You know, it wasn't a story. It was scenes, various scenes coupled together. I had different scenes. I mean, in one scene, I'm wearing a monkey fur coat and I'm being spanked by Pat Moran. In another scene, I have a bouquet of paper flowers and I'm throwing myself grief-stricken on some random headstone. And I can't remember what else, you know, but that may have been the only two scenes I did, but that's how I got started.
Did you have any desire for acting before that, or you just, because it sounds like you just kind of went for it?
I thought it would be fun, but I hadn't done anything to pursue it. I mean, I hopped at the chance. I dove, grabbed, bit, clawed for the chance when it was presented to me, but I had done nothing prior to that to make it happen.
And then you went on and you were in Mondo Trasho and Multiple Maniacs.
Yeah, Mondo Trasho, Multiple Maniacs, and then Pink Flamingos. In a sense, it was almost like learning film from the beginning, because the first one was 8 millimeter. The second one, Mondo Trasho, was 16 millimeter black and white without sound. Then Multiple Maniacs was 16 millimeter black and white with sync sound. And then Pink Flamingos was 16 millimeter color sync sound. So there was this evolution of the film that we were working on, as well as the actual movies.
Tell me how you came to the role of Peggy Gravel.
You mean, did I do any research? Or, you know, actually I did do research. I did actually one day of research, and this is what I did. I went out with the leg brace on. The leg brace, which is never explained. There was no explanation. I just wore it. John wanted me to wear a leg brace, so I wore a leg brace. But I actually went out one day with the leg brace on and walked around downtown Baltimore just to get a feel for it. And that was the entire extent of my research. I have no problem with tirades. Tirades are easy for me. You know, I barely have to work myself up to it. I can go from 0 to 60 in about 3.5 seconds. And that's just me. It was action, and I started yelling.
Wow. And then all that stuff was scripted for you as well?
Every word was scripted. I always came to the set. We all did. We all came to the set knowing our lines. I mean, I bring them to life, but John wrote them. I've been very lucky. I mean, Peggy and Dottie and Taffy have all had, and Connie, I mean, he has written some wonderful, wonderful lines for me.
I never realized how many E names you get to play in these movies.
Oh, yeah. Peggy, Dottie. Oh, yes. And, yeah.
Taffy, Connie.
Taffy. But then I'm Marge, the neuter. But yes, I'm a lot of E's. Maybe because my real name is Nancy.
So he probably wrote all these roles with you in mind, I mean, after the first film that you were in, right?
The early ones, yes. I don't think he wrote Marge the neuter for me, but he did write Dottie. Up through Dottie. Dottie was definitely written for me.
How was it filming Desperate Living? I've read about the sets being constructed out of garbage and the homeless people being bussed in and the rat infestation and all this kind of stuff. Was it a...
I think these are all really hyperbolic stories. We did have, in Mortville, we did have a lot of extras on, you know, the day that of the big outdoor scene when Queen Carlotta is killed and they bring her out to roast her as a pig and et cetera, et cetera. There were a lot of extras there that day. And there, unfortunately, it was winter and they were cold and there was a farmhouse, but it wasn't big enough to hold everybody. So people were actually standing around these tin barrel, you know, or steel barrel fires. That is how people were keeping warm. And there was a school bus and people could get on that, but it wasn't heated. So people did leave. A lot of people who had come out in their own vehicles did leave. And that was too bad because by the end of the day, it was hard to put the crowd together. And I couldn't join the crowd because I was supposed to be dead. And there really wasn't enough food. It just hadn't been planned as well as it might have been. And we were way out in the country. It wasn't like we could just run next door and buy subs. It was uncomfortable. Now, I, being a principal, was allowed in the farmhouse. So I was perfectly fine. Except for when we were actually filming outside and it was very cold. But I had a coat on, so it was okay. Physically, for me, it was great. The scenes where we filmed the interior of the castle, all of those scenes were filmed in a loft that was 2 blocks from my house. So that was incredibly wonderful for me. And my boyfriend was one of the goons. So it was fun having him around. I think he's the one that feeds me the cockroaches, which are actually raisins, by the way. But I think he's that one. I can't remember. It actually has been a while since I've watched the movie.
Did it get to service Queen Carlotta?
No, he was not one of those. No, he didn't have any actual scenes with Queen Carlotta.
Oh, poor guy.
He cried and cried about that.
How was it working with Edith Massey? I mean, was she the same person off screen as she was on?
Pretty much. Edith had a certain kind of street smart. You know, I mean, she'd been working as a bar girl. She lived by her wits, pretty much. But she wasn't really bright. I don't think she knew what she was saying half the time. I don't think she really comprehended her dialogue. She would say the words. I mean, I think she knew what each individual word was, but I don't think that she really understood what she was... I don't think she knows knew what a Hollywood loaf was. I mean, she certainly understood whip it out and show it hard. You know, she wasn't ignorant, but I don't think she half the time knew what she was saying. She didn't care. She was a good sport. You know, there were times when you could get frustrated with Edith because she didn't know her lines or she would forget her lines because he gave her tons and tons and tons of dialogue. But she was so willing to do these insane things. I mean, that poor woman, who I just learned recently was the age of my mother, was willing to sit in underwear, in a trailer, in a playpen for hours and hours and hours on end, freezing her little tail off. Well, her little big tail off. But she did it. She did it. She didn't complain. She didn't question. I mean, the woman was a sport. So you have to give her, you know, whatever else she might have been, however irritating she might have been on any other occasion, you have to really give her the props for that.
But I just loved her thick Baltimore accent, too.
Well, that is how she talked.
I'll admit, I didn't know what a Hollywood loaf was.
I had to ask.
One thing about John's films is they're very educational.
Right. And now you know what teabagging is.
Yeah, I never knew what shrimping was until Pink Flamingos, I think.
The first time John used shrimping was actually in Mondo Trasho. There's a shrimping scene.
My other question about Desperate Living is, how was it working with Gene Hill?
Well, it was wonderful in some ways and oddly irritating in others. In many respects, she was really great. But when it came time to our love scenes, she balked. There was the moment in the paddy wagon. I kiss her. I forget what the word, oh, Griselda, I forget what the word is. But I actually grab her and I kiss her. And she's going, oh, I can't kiss you. Oh, you're good. Kiss you. And I was like, and finally I turned and I said, Gene, your lips are bigger than my head, so you got to get over it. And then she calmed down. And then in the scene in the actual hut or room or wherever we were, where I had to pretend to be going down on her, which is something that my brother-in-law has seen this movie and constantly reminds me of. Whenever he can't think of anything to say to me, he says, "Seen any 400-pound black women lately?" She was so fat. She weighed approximately four times what I did at the time. She was so fat that even though I was scrunched down at the bottom of the bed, because all I could do was just scrunch down to get out of frame, I could see nothing. You know, her legs, the overlap of fat on her legs was so enormous that she might as well have been wearing clothes. As close as I was, I never saw her for JJ. The fact that I was pretending to go down on her, that didn't freak her out. It was the kiss. She was fine. I mean, and talk about another sport, to come from nowhere and meet John and put on that tutu. John has a way of getting people to do stuff. I mean, by Desperate Living, I was used to it. She was a newbie.
She was pretty much on top of you in the bed. I didn't know how comfortable that was for you.
It was mildly uncomfortable for a very short period of time, but I didn't care. I would do anything except set my hair on fire. I mean, I was perfectly happy with doing it. I have no problem with weird stuff on film. I know it's a movie. I know I'm acting. I don't have a problem. I mean, I have done plays with women. I did a play several times called Sleeping with Straight Men, in which I had to kiss a woman. And almost every woman that I did the play with, who played, you know, my love interest in the play, got squirrely about it. And I find that sort of thing very annoying. It's a part that you're playing. Nobody believes that you're really a lesbian. And if they did, who cares? Do you know what I mean? It seems to me to be just a bit too precious. Now, if you were to want me to be naked on screen now, 35 years later, it's not that I wouldn't do it, but you'd have to pay me a big bag of money to do it. The thing that a lot of people want to know is, you know, how was it doing Backwards Day? And that was, I mean, the people that I felt sorry for were the people that had to be naked, you know, the nude volleyball players. It was freezing. You know, I felt very bad for them. But Backwards Day was actually kind of fun. Here's my thing on Desperate Living. It's shrill. It is a scream from beginning to end. I do nothing but scream in it. Most everybody else screams in it. There's one quiet moment, which is actually, because it's quiet, is now my favorite moment in the entire movie. Well, there's two, actually. There's the one where Griselda and I are entering Mortville, and there's sort of fog rolling around the ground, and we're going, where are we? What is this? And it's right before we meet the Pie Man. So one other scene that is also quiet, and this is the only time in my history of working with John Waters that I have ever ad-libbed a line. And that is the scene where I'm making the rabies potion. I'm in the Princess Peggy outfit. I've got the, you know, the black gown on and the little crown on my head, and I'm stirring this big cauldron. And John says to me, he hasn't written anything for this scene, so I should just ad-lib something. Well, my jaw dropped. I'd never ad-libbed anything for John. You know, this was so totally verboten that I was stumped for a moment. But I did come up with the line, and I'm not sure if I'm quoting even myself correctly, but a pinch of bat and a touch of rat, or something to that effect. And that is the only line that I have ever ad-libbed in any John Waters movie. But that scene is also quiet. But every other scene in that movie is just screaming, screaming, screaming. So I suggest anybody who goes, take earplugs.
That is quite an outfit you get to wear in that.
Yes, it is. I do like that outfit. I will tell you one other story. There's the scene where I'm being shot, and when they're killing me, where Mole McHenry, Sulo, is actually killing me, and she shoots me in the butt. I'm lying there across the bed, and I don't know, I think there might have been a pig or roasted. I forget what I'm actually lying across. And John says to me, just hold on a second, just stay there, just where you are just for a second, which I do. In a moment, I feel this wet, cold, slimy thing on my butt. John has gone and acquired a piece of liver, which he puts on my butt and takes the film shot of that. He probably didn't tell me ahead of time because I might have said, ew, I don't want to do that. But I didn't fight it. Once it was done, it was done.
I don't know what this says about me, but I think I'd rather have the liver than having the cockroaches that Liz Renee had going across her.
You know, maybe. It was, because at least the liver was dead. And at the time, I wasn't a vegetarian yet, so I wouldn't have been grossed out by it. It's just an example of the one more thing that makes John John.
Let's talk a little bit about your singing career here. How did you get started with singing?
I was in my very first band back in Provincetown in the winter of 70-71, and I was a backup singer. And we did three performances, and it was really fun. And then in the early 70s, I sang with the Cockettes. I did a number called No No's Nanook, in a show called Vice Palace. I'm actually putting that song on the album. But that was kind of it. I never really pursued singing. I always enjoyed it. I always thought I had a medium decent voice. But then I took singing lessons when I lived in New York. I lived in New York from 77 through 89, and I did take singing lessons while I was there. And my teacher kept pushing me sort of towards legit, you know, that Broadway belt, which I was never really comfortable with. So I kind of just let it go. And then about 10 years ago, actually it was almost 10 years ago, I was doing a play with the LA Women Shakespeare Company called The Winter's Tale, and I was playing the singing peddler. And a friend of mine who is a musician and a songwriter who used to be with a band called Extra Fancy, his name is Brian Grillo, G-R-I-L-L-O, he came to see me in the play, and he was kind of blown away by the fact that I could sing. So he had a song that he wanted me to perform at this beer bust club that he did once a month on a Sunday afternoon at this leather bar in Silver Lake. And I said, sure. And he put together a couple of musicians for me and rehearsed a couple of times and we did the song and the audience went crazy. And they were screaming for more. And I said, I don't have any more, but I'll sing this one for you again. So I did the same song again. And I was hooked. I was completely hooked. And Brian was just amazing for me. I've never been helped so much to get something started in my life. He found me musicians. He put together a band for me. He wrote, he gave me songs to sing. And I just started performing in town. You know, I started performing around L.A., mostly on the leather bar circuit. The thing that was tough for me, though, was the fact that I wasn't really very good at it. So I had to be out there kind of learning how to do this, be myself on a stage and sing, already being fairly well known. You know, people come up to me and go, oh, you were really great. And I know that I hadn't been. You know what I mean? I know the show hadn't been that great, but I was learning and you have to do it. It's what you have to do. You cannot learn to perform by yourself. You have to do it in front of people. And I eventually got to the point where, you know, I had some personnel changes in the band, finally put a band together that I was really, really happy with. And I started doing one-woman shows at this place called the Cavern Club, which is the basement of a Mexican restaurant in Silver Lake. And I started getting to where I was really very comfortable with it. And that's when I left L.A. and came to Baltimore, where I had to start all over again. But I have, and I love the band I work with now. I was very happy getting back in the rehearsal room. I'm not a trained musician by any stretch of the imagination, and to hear the keyboard player and my bass player talking about diminished what's it, you know, it just makes my heart sing.
Are you continuing to play the leather bar circuit, but this time in Baltimore?
No, I haven't. That was all in L.A. I don't really have a leather. I don't know that there is a leather bar circuit here.
I love that there can be a leather bar circuit any place.
But in L.A., there kind of is one, yes. Although the Gauntlet, which is the place where I started, has, I don't know whether it's still there under another name or whatever, but it's the Gauntlet as the Gauntlet no longer exists. But that's where I got my start. I mean, I really, truly did get my start at a place called the Gauntlet. How appropriate. I was very happy there, and I also loved working at the Cavern Club, the basement of the Mexican restaurant. It's a wonderful little performance room that holds up to about 75 people, and it was a wonderful, intimate place.
What kind of places are you playing now when you're in Baltimore?
We're not playing at all. We haven't been playing for a while. The last show we all did together was the Christmas show.
Okay, well, that was, what, up in Harrisburg you did one?
Well, we did it in Harrisburg, but we did it in Baltimore, too, at the Creative Alliance. After the Christmas show, you know, I haven't had a keyboard player, and Walker was, the bass player was on tour with another band. Skiz has been busy with a bunch of stuff. I was out in L.A., you know, working on a movie for this and that. You know, we've just kind of gotten away. I haven't lost focus completely, but, you know, I've been practicing on my own at home, but it's not, we haven't been together in the rehearsal room for, well, I guess Walker and Skiz and I were a few months ago trying to figure out what our next step was. But, I mean, that was probably April. Glenn, the new keyboard player, joining us, puts us right back on our track. But my primary focus at this moment is getting the CD done. That is the big thing, the mountain that I am climbing at the moment.
And what kind of stuff is going to be on the CD?
It's very eclectic. Have you heard the Sometimes I Wish I Had a Gun? Okay, you have to hear that. John put it on his A Date with John Waters album that he released in 2008.
Yeah, he had mentioned that he put a song of yours out.
Yes. And it's really quite nice, and it was written by my pal Brian Grillo, and we recorded it in a garage, and it just came out really good. I mean, if you go to facebook.com/minkstallfans, it's on my band page, and that's one of the songs that's going to be, but my voice is off. I would call myself more of a crooner than anything else. I'm doing a remake of Female Trouble. You know, Divine sang it for the soundtrack, but I'm doing a remake of it, and it's very dynamic. I'm really happy with it. You know, we have a couple of songs that are more rock. We have a couple of songs that are a little jazzier. And I'm also doing No Nose Nanook that I did with the Cockettes, you know, back in 1972, which is a little ditty about a woman who was so promiscuous with rubbing noses that she doesn't have one anymore. It's on the Cockettes movie soundtrack, but not by me. I will be reprising my own song that I did. I'm calling the album A Memoir of My Life in Songs Written by Other People. Because although it's not really an autobiographical journey, each one of the songs means something very specific to me and was at something either that I did before or has something to do with some sort of turning point in my life.
When people want to get this CD of yours, I know it's not going to be out for a little bit, but where can they go to possibly pre-order it?
Minkstole.com. I have a gift shop on there, and I will have a place for pre-ordering the CD. I don't know when it's going to be out yet. I'm hoping by Christmas, but that's a hope, not a promise.
GGTMC live for you, fresh air. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
We're back. That was a little music from Desperate Living. Again, talking about the production values, this was the first John Waters film with an orchestral score. Usually, Waters uses a lot of older music, which I love the scores for his films. Not a big fan of, what was the Dirty Shame, but I did enjoy the music in that one, if I had to say that there was one good thing about it. Justin, this is neither here nor there, but I wanted to tell you about the first time I saw this movie. You know, we were talking about seeing some of these John Waters films in the theater. At one point, when I was at school, they had a film society, and they would play movies every Friday and Saturday night. They had a few, actually, on campus, and it was always a matter of, am I going to go see something at Angel Hall, or am I going to see it at the Natural Science Center, or am I going to see it at the Modern Languages Building? And the Modern Languages Building guys, they were doing two nights of John Waters stuff, and it was a whole festival. And you get there, and it was like $6 or something really crazy cheap to see three movies that night. And they had piles and piles of cookies, Mrs. Fields cookies there, all these oatmeal cookies. Somehow they had taught a rep from Mrs. Fields into bankrolling this whole John Waters festival of like renting these prints and stuff. And so it was great. You know, I got to see these movies on a fairly big screen, really nice quality. The second night I show up, they still have the three movies playing. No cookies. The guy got up there to introduce the whole thing, and he's like, yeah, we had a rep here from Mrs. Fields last night, and they didn't realize what John Waters films were like, so they're not sponsoring us anymore. So yeah, I always associate John Waters films with oatmeal cookies now, but I'm probably one of the few.
That's intense. I don't remember the first time I saw Desperate Living, to be honest with you. I love it. I'm a huge fan of it, actually. But I can't even recall the first time I saw it. I'm sure it was just something I'd rented on video. Not as good a story as yours.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Edith Massey. Edith, one of these, like, found actresses, very genuine, and I think basically playing herself in these films, though maybe not necessarily aware of it. So I know that you're a fan of Edith's musical career. Can you talk a little bit about that?
She capitalized on her Waters fame and went out and did this whole tour where she fronted this punk band called Edie and the Eggs. And I'm not sure if you have ever heard Punks Get Off the Grass.
I have not.
Oh, it's on YouTube. You got to check it out. But her whole music was a lot of spoken word stuff, you know, Edie-isms, just how she would pronounce dialogue. And she translates that and puts it into music as well. But, you know, then there's really interesting, you know, she did covers of oldies You know, like I want to say I've heard her do a cover of Be My Baby, which is just hilarious. And it's all stuff on YouTube. She did some 7 inches of Punks Get Off the Grass. It's such a good song. It's just like, hey, punks, get off the grass. It's awesome, man. You got to check it out. You know, that's what I love about Waters' movies is, you know, a lot of the times you don't have professional actors. And this, the Waters films are, not to put John Waters down, but some of the earlier films just feel like really great student movies, you know?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. And each of the characters, you can see why, you know, he uses them because they are very distinctive personalities. You know, everyone knows about Divine, but I always feel like, you know, David Lockery was a really underrated character in these movies. And I also am a huge admirer of Mary Vivian Pierce. I think she's, I don't know, I think she's pretty hot, actually.
And then what about the movie Mutants in Paradise?
Edie made, of course, she made the John Waters movies, and she was slated, I've seen her audition, she was going to be in Paul Bartel's Lust in the Dust. It was going to be Tab Hunter, Divine, and Edie in those three roles.
Oh,
and
wow.
She actually passed away before they could start working on it, but the last movie she did was this really obscure movie called Mutants in Paradise, and it's only on VHS. It's kind of, I mean, you can get it on Amazon if you, you know, it's like probably $25, but it's just really, really bizarre movie that's sort of like this, you know, Surf 2 meets The Bionic Woman or something. Yeah, it's really bizarre, and I have a copy of it, but yeah, it's, of course, she does, it's Edith Massey, you know, so it's not like, you know, Edie could deliver, you know, some kind of epic performance. It's more Edie. It's the Edie that you've known and loved all these years in another movie that's not John Waters.
I'm trying to think of other performance roles that she could have done, you know.
It's Edie as Bridget Jones' Diary.
Dear Diary. I find this one fascinating that it's the origin of the film is John Waters looking at a magazine called Desperate Living for lesbians, and just that horrible title. The title for the movie is perfect, but that as a like a pro-lesbian magazine being called that, it's like, wow, they needed to be empowered at this time. It's funny because lesbian movies have never really been in vogue, at least as far as non-pornographic lesbian movies, let's say. But even just last year, like The Kids Are All Right was very pro-lesbian and was getting all these accolades and stuff. And it's very, I would find it very funny to compare the two films. I know that there have been, you know, a couple other good lesbian films throughout the years. And you made a pretty darn good list here of some of your favorites, or at least some of the ones that we should talk about.
You know, there's probably been a couple anti-lesbian movies, but real fast, I think the title Desperate Living for a magazine is awesome. I think it is very bad taste, and I can see why John Waters would like that. You know, in terms of the films, there's been some, you know, some standout films. I seem to recall really enjoying The Incredible Adventures of Two Girls in Love. And I think the director of that also, didn't she make High Art as well with Ally Sheedy? I think so. We had Bound, which was really popular and kind of talked about for being a lesbian movie. You had the underseen Bar Girls with Ray Dong Chong. You had the critical Darling Boys Don't Cry, Chasing Amy. You know, back to the 60s, you had Andy Warhol's Chelsea Girls. And then, of course, one of my favorite films, which is, you know, the lesbianism is not as pertinent to the story as it should be, I don't think, but you have Showgirls as well.
Another lesbian couple from Verhoeven, you know, we talked about Basic Instinct a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
I seem to remember there was one called Go Fish that was around the time of The Incredible Adventures of Two Girls in Love.
Yeah, that was, I remember that one. It was like an independent film, but it was like backed by Fox. It came out like around the same time as like, I want to say it didn't come out as same time as like The Full Monty or Shallow Grave around those, you know, the Danny Boyle movie. I kind of remember it coming out. I can remember the cover of it very distinctly.
It was kind of like during that time when indie movies were kind of getting their day in the sun there, when you had to put indie in quotation marks because you never knew where the money was necessarily coming from. Have you ever had a chance to see the film But I'm a Cheerleader with Natasha Lyonne?
I have. I've seen that one. Yep.
I enjoy that one. That one's pretty good. And there's one called Butch Camp, which I've been wanting to see for a while, too.
Great title.
Yeah. Oh, well, Judy Tenuta is in it, so I'm...
Ooh!
Yeah, exactly. Curious to see that.
Speaking of Natasha, there wasn't there some kind of lesbian aspect to the Psycho Beach Party?
I want to say there was. I know for sure there was a character in drag in Psycho Beach Party, and then she was a lesbian in Freeway 2 as well.
And then that newer movie, wasn't that movie called Lick? Wasn't that about like young girls? Oh, Heavenly Creatures?
Heavenly Creatures, yeah. Oh, that one was great, though. That one was absolutely terrific.
If I was going to be a lesbian, it would be in Heavenly Creatures.
It's very funny to me how Paulette has changed over the years. Now she's on like 2.5 Men. To think that that's the same actress playing both characters, it's like, wow, really? She really kind of has made good.
And she was in Adam Rifkin's Detroit Rock City.
Yeah, and I want to say, wasn't she in Coyote Ugly as well?
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I actually like Coyote Ugly.
No, I like Coyote Ugly as well, believe it or not. I'm a huge Piper Pierbo fan. So let's think more about lesbians while we take a break here. And we'll be back in a minute with the third half of our show.
The Ambersons. Literature's most fascinating family, brought to the screen by the magic of Orson Welles. Richard Bennett plays old Major Amberson, tyrannical head of a family that had all the rights of royalty and none of its responsibilities. Dolores Costello returns to the screen with a magnificent portrayal of Isabel, the Major's daughter, who left the man she loved to wed another who was more acceptable. From Citizen Kane, you'll remember Agnes Moorehead, who plays thin, spinsterish Aunt Fanny, a lonely woman in a house of wealth. No one would guess that Fanny had a secret love. Ray Collins is Uncle Jack, the black sheep of the Andersons. And Joseph Cotton, who plays Eugene Morgan, the man who came out of the past to find his first love once again. And finally, Isabel's boy, young George, played by Tim Holt, headstrong, impetuous, and arrogant heir to the splendor of the world. Young George, who hated Eugene Morgan, the man his mother really loved, stood between their happiness like an avenging angel.
Don't you think you should tell George?
About us?
Yes.
You're not wanted in this house, Mr. Morgan.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Perhaps you'll understand this.
So scandal at last attacked the House of Amberson. Scandal spread by Isabel's own sister. Scandal spread by her own son, who broke into every house in town to make them take back the things they said about his mother. That high and mighty Amberson girl who fell in love just once too often. The Magnificent Ambersons brings you many of the Mercury players you first saw in Citizen Kane. It brings you Orson Welles as commentator, director, and producer of a truly distinguished and exciting motion picture.
That was audio for next week's show. It's going to be a very special show. We'll be coming to you from inside the Orson Welles Archive at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where we'll be discussing the 1942 Welles film, The Magnificent Ambersons, and discovering rare Amberson materials on the air, stuff that hasn't been seen in over 70 years. Justin, what kind of stuff are we going to be looking at?
Well, we'll actually have the opportunity to be taking a look at the Robert Wise Amberson's editing transcripts, just his notes on the cutting of the film, multiple versions of the Amberson screenplay by Orson Welles. We'll be looking at the test screening audience reports from RKO Studios, and then also a ton of behind-the-scenes photos. And more importantly, we'll be bringing you a special interview I did with Orson Welles' daughter, Christopher Welles. It was by Chris's amazing invitation that Mike and I are able to get into the U of M archive to see this amazing stuff.
So that's all coming to you next week. If you enjoyed this show, or even if you didn't, please spread the word. Let your friends and neighbors know all about the projection booth.
And be sure to visit the show's official website at projection-booth.com, or you can grab the show up on iTunes or listen at Jackalope Radio and leave feedback, please.
We're going to leave you this week with a song that will be a bonus track on Mink Stole's upcoming CD, Do Re Mink. So Mink just got done doing a whole Kickstarter campaign for her CD, and hopefully we'll be going into the studio relatively soon with her fabulous band from Baltimore, including one of our frequent show contributors, Skiz Sizek, playing drums on that record. So hopefully folks will be sure to check that out, and be sure to check out Mink's website and go on there, and you can pre-order the CD, you can order some pictures, whatever you want to do, and that's over at minkstole.com. That's the official Mink Stole website. Let's go ahead and get our gun on.
Sometimes I wish I had a gun, so you and I could be alone. You'd be my hostage for the day, and you'd do just what I say. I'd aim it at your arms and make you wrap them round. I'd aim it at your lips and make you say you love me. I'd aim it at your eyes, give a look of love, and we'd be happy, baby. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. Whenever you go walking by, you wouldn't give me that look when my gun caught your eye. I'd aim it at your arms, you'd wrap them round me. I'd aim it at your lips and make you want to kiss me. I'd aim it at your eyes, you'd give a look of love, and we'd be happy, baby. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. I wish I had a gun, 'cause competition isn't fun. I'd aim it at those other gals, and we'd see how fast they run. I'd point it at your arms, you'd wrap them round me. I'd point it at your lips, and you would kiss me. I'd point it at your heart, you'd feel so full of love, and we'd be happy, baby. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. 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 Sometimes I wish I had a gun.